Good morning, and once again, welcome as we have assembled on this beautiful Lord's Day. It is good to see the presence of everyone whom we have in our midst. As was mentioned in the announcements, we do have visitors with us, and we are especially honored for your presence. We are glad that you are with us, and we want to invite you to come back and be with us at every opportunity that you have. We meet each Sunday evening at 6 o'clock for an evening worship service similar to the one that we have engaged in this morning, and we also have Bible studies on Wednesday nights at 7:30, as well as Sunday mornings at 9:45 with classes for all ages. If you have questions about something that you observe in the way that we worship God, or if you have questions about something said in this lesson, see me following the services, and we will do our best to give our answer according to God's Word, for we strive in all that we do to put Him first and to worship Him, and we must respect His will and His instructions in so doing. One thing I forgot to mention in the announcements, I received a phone call yesterday from Bobby Carlisle, and of course we know that Edith is continually dealing with various health issues, and he's asked for our prayers once again as she's dealing with some tests concerning some things of a pretty serious nature. And so they asked for our prayers on her behalf. And the other thing that I wanted to just kind of remind you about, I've mentioned this before, but if you are available on Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock our time, I am engaged in an online Bible study with a couple of other preachers. Actually, we've expanded that to three other preachers now, on the web at a website called live.truthfactor.com. And that's Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock Pacific time. If you want more information about that, see me following the services. At this time, we are engaged in a study of the book of James, and we are in chapter 2. And feel free to join us for that. It's just another way that we can use the resources that we have to further the cause of Christ. There's so much bad that's a result of the medias that are around us, whether it be internet and television and other such things today. But good can come from those resources as well, and we certainly want to support that to whatever degree that we can. Well, on to the lesson at hand. We have been in a study over the course of the past couple of years, or last year and a little bit before that, where we've been dealing with the life of Jesus. And we are bringing our study to its conclusion, and we have come to the portion of that study where we are dealing with the resurrection of Jesus. And as a matter of fact, over the course of the past two lessons, we have been dealing with the resurrection of Jesus. You may recall that 2 weeks ago in our study, we looked at the actual accounts as they are recorded in the last chapters of each of the first three Gospels, in the last two chapters, or chapter 20 in the Gospel of John, as we look at the various appearances that Jesus made and address some things concerning that. And then last week, and I'm continuing that particular study this week, we are dealing with what you might describe as some apologetics concerning the resurrection of Jesus, and that is answering the question, did Jesus actually arise from the dead? It is important that we be able to give an answer for this. We can't just say, I believe that He arose from the dead, because there are many out there. Some two-thirds of the world deny the so-called Christianity, that is, belief in Jesus as the Son of God. And many of them are going to try to discredit the fact that Jesus arose. If you can discredit the fact that Jesus arose from the dead, you discredit Christianity altogether. And incidentally, that's one of the points that Paul made in 1 Corinthians 15. Come back tonight, where we are continuing a study of 1 Corinthians, and we just happen to be in chapter 15, and we will be dealing a little bit with that this evening. Now, in our last lesson last week, one of the things that we discussed was we talked about the conduct of the eyewitnesses, and we showed how that argues for the resurrection. And to put it simply, what we observed last week is when you look at the way that those who were disciples of Christ conducted themselves after His resurrection, it argues toward the fact that Jesus did arise from the dead. You're not going to live your life and totally devote yourself to a fraud. And there were just too many witnesses for there not to be someone to step forward and deny that Jesus arose from the dead if he did not arise from the dead. So when you look at their conduct, and you look at the way they lived their lives, and you look at the things that they were willing to sacrifice, the purity of life that they lived, there was nothing self-serving about that conduct. And it just lends an argument that he actually did arise from the dead. And that brings us to what we want to discuss in our lesson this morning. There are many so-called theories out there as to explain away the resurrection. And of course, these theories are based on the fact that Jesus did live upon this earth. And that's actually one of those things that you cannot really deny, if you have any integrity whatsoever, because that Jesus lived is verified in numerous external sources. And we're actually going to get to a couple of those at the conclusion of this lesson. But nevertheless, there are many who want to discredit the resurrection for whatever reason. They do not want to accept Christianity. They do not want to accept what the Bible teaches as to what you must do. They do not want to accept that Jesus is the Son of God and that He is our Savior. And thus they are expected to follow after Him. And so you have all these arguments that are being made to try to explain the conduct of the disciples following His resurrection. And this morning I want to devote some time to some of these theories and then make a few observations about the resurrection as we bring this lesson to its conclusion. And as I've mentioned, next week we're going to deal with some of His post-resurrection discourses after that initial day. We're going to talk about Thomas a little bit in John 21 with His discussion with Peter there. And then we're going to talk about His ascension and conclude our study with His second coming. But on to the theories, some of the theories refuting the resurrection. The first one that we want to mention is that there are some who say that when Jesus appeared, that what appeared was actually not His physical body, but rather that it was a vision or it was His spirit. Some describe it as a hallucination. When we use the term ghost, the idea of what a ghost is the way that some purport that Jesus actually appeared to individuals following his crucifixion. Now, of course, this would be those who believe that there is something more than this life, but they deny miracles. They deny the resurrection per se. However, if you study the various accounts, one of the things that you will note is that Jesus had to have resurrected physically. And that's something that the disciples sought to establish very, very clearly. And I hope that we can see that as we go through this lesson. Turn to Luke chapter 24, and here is a passage that we actually read a couple of weeks ago, but this passage here summarizes how the body of Jesus had to be a physical body. In Luke 24, in verse number 39, as Jesus appears to the disciples, to His apostles, most of them, as well as others, on the day that He arose, He says, "Behold my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit does not have flesh and bones as you see I have." So Jesus Himself dispelled the rumor that He was a ghost, or that He was merely a spirit. He told them, "Touch me. Look at the wounds on my hands. Look at the wounds on my feet." But then we continue reading. When He had said this, He showed them His hands and feet. But while they still did not believe for joy and marveled, He said to them, "Have you any food here?" So they gave Him a piece of broiled fish and some honeycomb. And He took it and ate in their presence. That is a very powerful statement that Luke is making there. He took food on the day that He arose and He ate it. Ghosts, if you believe in those types of things, whatever, they don't physically eat food. That was the point he was making. It is my physical body. The body that was nailed to the cross. The body that you have been with for 3 years. That body arose from the dead. That was the point that Jesus was making there. In 1 John chapter 1 and in verse number 1, a passage that we also mentioned a couple of weeks ago, as John begins this epistle, the way he begins it is by saying, that which was from the beginning, which we heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and our hands have handled concerning the Word of life. John is making an argument that Jesus physically arose from the dead. And if you've studied the book of John, this first letter to John, you'll find that one of the arguments that he is dealing with is the doctrine of Gnosticism. LB handed us a paper this morning about Gnosticism. And basically, Gnosticism made a distinction between the body and the spirit. Gnosticism denied the physical resurrection of Jesus. And John is writing, among other reasons, to dispute that. He says, we handled his body. We saw him. We spoke with him. And various other things that would indicate that. And he goes on, and when he talks about the Antichrist in 1 John, 1 John 2, 22, 23, and chapter 4, 2 and 3, he's talking about those who deny that Jesus came in the flesh. Is against Christ. He's Antichrist when he does that. But in addition to that, you might also consider that in the Gospel, or not in the Gospels, but in the Epistles, and in the preaching of the Apostles, as recorded in the book of Acts, you'll sometimes hear the description that Jesus was raised from the dead. That particular expression is a reference to a physical raising. An example of it is in John chapter 12 and in verse number 1. And I ask you to turn over here, and this is a point of reference. John chapter 12 and in verse number 1. You remember what happened in John chapter 11? Lazarus was raised from the dead. After being dead for several days, Jesus commanded that he come forth from the grave. And then it says in John chapter 12 and in verse number 1, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany where Lazarus was, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. The physical body of Lazarus was raised from the dead. Now I want you to think about how often that expression is used. Do a search of it. How often that expression is used throughout the New Testament. And things similar to that. And the indication is that Jesus was physically raised from the dead. In Acts chapter 3 and in verse number 15. Acts chapter 3 and in verse number 15. Peter there says that to them that you killed the Prince of Life, whom God raised from the dead, of which we are witnesses. Just a few moments in another point, we're going to talk about Acts 2 and the sermon that Peter preached on the day of Pentecost. He was making an argument about Jesus being raised from the dead. And you can go to numerous others of these examples that you have here. Let's turn to Romans chapter 4 and verse number 24. Romans 4 and verse number 24. You find there in that passage, Paul there says, verse 23, now it was not written for his sake alone that it was imputed to him, but also for us. It shall be imputed to us who believe in him who raised up Jesus our Lord from the dead. His indication is we believe that Jesus raised him from the dead. Romans 6, verse 3. Romans 6, verse 3. Do you not know that as many of us as were baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death, that therefore we were buried with him through baptism into death, that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, even so we also should walk in newness of life. For if we have been united together in the likeness of his death, certainly we also shall be in the likeness of his resurrection. Notice he talks about our baptism. It is a demonstration. It recreates, if you will, the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. Now let me ask you, what body goes down into the water? It's a physical body. It is immersed in the water in baptism. What body comes out? The physical body, the same body. Even though spiritually you put to death the man of sin, the man of righteousness comes out of the water. You are a new creation. You are saved. But your same physical body is raised out of the water. The same way that the same body of Jesus was buried. It was crucified, buried, and it came forth from the grave. So there's no argument to justify that Jesus was a spirit or a hallucination. And then furthermore, when you examine the various appearances, you'll notice that we noted that on more than one occasion Jesus appeared to more than just one or two people. He appeared to the apostles at least three times recorded, and probably more than that. On one occasion, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 15 that he appeared to more than 500 on one occasion. That's not consistent with a ghost, the appearance of a ghost, or somebody having an hallucination. Usually that's an individual thing. And so that just argues against it. And he made multiple appearances to the same individuals. And you add to that everything that he did. The argument that he was spiritually just a hallucination or his spirit that resurrected does not hold water. Well, another argument that is sometimes made is that his body was stolen by the disciples. You may recall there was actually a group that advanced that. It was the Jews who had Jesus crucified. In Matthew 28, verses 11 through 16, after the soldiers who were guarding the grave, at the request of the enemies of Jesus, witnessed His resurrection, they go and they tell the council. And it says there in verses 11 through 16 that they bribed the guards to say that the disciples came and stole the body. And Matthew even says, as he's writing this, that to this day, that argument is still being stated. The disciples presented the Bible. But what about that? And I would ask the question, and this goes back to what we talked about last week. Why would His disciples, and in particular, why would those who were the leaders die and give up all that they had for a known deception? If His body was stolen by His disciples, it would have been disciples who had the ability to do that, and they would have been in influential positions as far as His teachings were concerned. Why would they live the lives that they lived perpetrating a fraud? And that's exactly what you are talking about here. You're talking about an outright deception, a lie. Again, that's what Paul says. In 1 Corinthians 15, verses 12 and following. He says, if we say that Christ has risen from the dead, if He hasn't risen, we're liars. And our message is meaningless. So to make that argument really doesn't make sense. And furthermore, there were too many disciples for none of them to admit that it was a fraud. And the point that I am making with that is Jesus spent 3 years with the 12 apostles. And over and over we read about women who were following after Him. And He had a group of disciples that were following Him. He had a number of disciples, some from whom a replacement for Judas Iscariot could be found. And they had to have been with Him during that time. Now, when you start having that many individuals, if a fraud is being presented and if some type of a fraud or a deception is taking place to deceive the masses, what are the odds that everybody involved would be willing to live their lives the way that they did? And that nobody would come forward and break and admit that it was a fraud? You know, we just got done studying, or last quarter we studied on world religions. We talked about Islam, and we talked a little bit about Muhammad there. And I remember on one occasion we discussed there was a disciple of Muhammad who, because of Muhammad's conduct, renounced Islam. And what it really amounted to was Muhammad was claiming to receive visions from God. And he would utter these sayings. And this one disciple was writing down what he said. And then he would make suggestions. You know, it would be better if it's this way. You know, this might be better wording. And Muhammad would say, okay. Well, he was convinced if he was really receiving visions from God, Muhammad would not allow him to change a word of it. And he renounced it. Well, you compare that to if the disciples were perpetrating a fraud, somebody is going to say, I can't live with this anymore. But that did not happen. And then, and I want you to ask this question with every one of these arguments. What about the appearances? What about the appearances afterward? That doesn't answer it. And furthermore, what about the empty tomb? Well, another argument that is made is that the enemies, either the Roman soldiers themselves or the Jews, that they took the body. And the reason they did so was because of the claims of Jesus, and they were fearful the disciples would. And so they took the body before the disciples did, and they hid it, so they couldn't make the claim. And then the disciples, they, when they saw the body wasn't there, they went around and said, He's arisen, He's arisen. Well, in studying the accounts a couple of weeks ago, we've already noted that there was doubt even after He arose. That's why Jesus, as we read a few moments ago, He had to say, touch my hand. They were skeptical until they physically saw the body. But here's the point. Let's just suppose that the Jews stole the body and put it somewhere else. If they wanted to end Christianity once and for all, if they wanted to stop the disciples of Christ once and for all from preaching and teaching, it would have been very simple. They were saying He's arisen from the dead. Peter on the day of Pentecost, He arose from the dead. David's grave's here. David is still in his grave. Where is the Lord? That's the question he's asking. He's risen from the dead. It would have been very simple for the Jews, you know, oh, you know what? I got something I want to show you. All they would have had to do was produce the body. And everything associated with the disciples of Jesus would have been done. There would be no more Christianity. And of course you have the account of the bribing of the soldiers. And furthermore, this doesn't explain the conversions of Paul and James, and we talked a little bit about that last week. Remember, Paul was one out of due season, and that's really what we're going to address in our lesson this evening, how he was one born out of due season. The Lord appeared to Paul. You cannot explain that with the enemies stealing the body, because Paul was an enemy. And he was pretty influential too. Don't you suppose he would have known? Well, another argument that is sometimes made is they say that they went to the wrong tomb because the women were so distraught when Jesus died that he was buried in a tomb and they went away for the Sabbath, and then when they came back on the first day of the week, perhaps it was still dark, which John's account tells us that's when Mary Magdalene began, but the other said that they came during daylight. But nevertheless, they'll say that they went and they actually went to an empty tomb, and it just happened to be the wrong tomb. And when they saw that the tomb was empty, they panicked and they ran away, or else rejoicing they ran away, and they said, just like he said, he is arisen from the dead. But here's some things to consider. How many people, and remember, you have more than one. You know, three or four women are mentioned, plus you have Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus, who buried Jesus. And correct me if I'm wrong, Joseph provided the tomb. Do you suppose Joseph knew where his own tomb was? You don't have just one person. You have several individuals. Would they all have not remembered the same tomb or where the tomb was? And especially for a loved one like that. What would be the possibility of that taking place? And it just doesn't make sense. But here's another thing to consider. If they went to the wrong tomb, and they remember that Jesus said, I'm going to arise from the dead, all of a sudden, excitedly, they start preaching, he's not there, he's arisen. What would the enemies have done? Correct me if I'm wrong, but the tomb of Jesus was sealed by Roman soldiers. How long do you think it would have taken the Jews, just as if they were the ones that stole the body, the enemies, to say, well, here, I got something I want to show you. And just take them and produce the body of Jesus. Produce a proper grave. And again, you've dispelled the argument that he arose from the dead. But they did not do that. Another argument that is sometimes made, and this is always an interesting one. I get a kick out of this argument, which is called the swoon theory. And in essence, what the swoon theory states is that Jesus did not actually die on the cross. That what he did is he swooned or he fainted. Or he went into a comatose state. Into a deep comatose state because of the trauma against his body. And then his body was taken down from the cross. It was put in the tomb by Joseph Arimathea and it was wrapped. And perhaps the spices that were used and the wrappings and the cool damp air in the tomb as it was closed, provided an environment for healing. And then, a couple of days later, he was able to wake up. He woke up from his coma or his fainting or whatever, and then he found his way out of the grave, out of the tomb, and then he began making his appearances after that. And of course, this explains appearances. This explains how Jesus, even after he was crucified, was able to make appearances to others. And there's just a few things I want you to think about with this. Number one, you'd be questioning the integrity of the Roman soldiers who carried out the execution. I'm convinced that the Roman soldiers entrusted with the execution of Jesus and the other criminals knew what they were doing. It was their job. They knew how to execute somebody. And they knew how to verify that they were dead. You know, you're not dealing with somebody taking a pot shot with a bow and arrow. You're dealing with a physical crucifixion that took hours. And you're dealing with a Roman government that perfected this method of execution. So when the soldiers went to Pilate and told Pilate that he is dead, they meant it. In addition to that, a spear was thrust in his side as recorded by John. History tells us that the reason soldiers would thrust a spear in the side of those who were supposedly dead or about to die is for one of two reasons. Number one, for humane reasons, because they wanted to spare the individual any more suffering that they were always going through. But incidentally, understand that that's not typically the case. Typically, they wanted them to suffer as long as possible. And there was documentation of sometimes a person being on a cross 2 or 3 days before they finally died. Well, a spear could be thrust into the heart to hasten the death process. And one reason they might want to do that is because the soldiers had to stay there until the body was dead. Now you hear me on that. If a crucifixion takes 2 days, 3 days, guess what those soldiers have to do? They have to stay on post for 2 to 3 days. If they can hasten his death, then they can leave and go about with their business, go into town. Well, we are told in the text that the reason the deaths were hastened on this occasion was because of the high Sabbath, and that's why the legs of the other two criminals were broken. But when they came to Jesus, they saw that he was already dead. However, it wasn't just a visual confirmation. The soldier, according to John, thrust a spear in his side, probably his heart, and blood and water poured forth, verifying that he was dead. And the way that body and fluids exit a body that is dead is different from the way that body fluids exit a body that is still alive. I know that's gross to say, but it's medical fact. They verified that he was dead. And that wound was designed to ensure that he was dead. So that's one thing to consider about that. In addition to that, the body of Jesus was handled by his disciples, Joseph of Arimathea, Nicodemus. Perhaps the women handled the body. We're not told that. They were there. Would they have known if his body was dead? In addition to that, the degree of punishment that Jesus suffered, both mentally and physically, even prior to his death, the beatings that he endured, the mockings, the crown of thorns on his head, everything together, the physical trauma, would not lend to one surviving the torture of a crucifixion. And that's what it was. In addition to that, I want you to think about the quality of his appearances afterward. Let's suppose that somehow he swooned and then his body woke up. How do you explain him rolling away a stone that was probably several hundred pounds at minimum, and more likely 2,000 or 3,000 pounds? How would you explain him being able to roll that away? And when you look at his appearances, do his appearances seem to indicate that he's in a weakened state as he speaks to these individuals? He appeared with two men that were going on the road to Emmaus. Do you remember how far Emmaus was from Jerusalem? 7 miles. Jesus walked with them the majority of the way, and he was coherent as he was able to carry on a conversation with them about resurrection, by the way. A wounded body. You break a toe. Try walking 5 miles. He walked with them for all this length of time. The appearances of Jesus indicate not a weakened strength, but a strong strength. He was resurrected. And I'd also ask this, if Jesus didn't die on the cross, when did he die? You still have to answer the question, where is his body? That's a challenge. And you still have to answer where the lives of his disciples are concerned, as far as that goes. But there's something else I want you to think about with this particular theory. Over 12 times, Jesus told his disciples before he would die that he was going to die. And on many of those occasions, he told them that he would arise from the dead. I'm going to die, but 3 days later, I will be raised from the dead. And I want you to add to that Psalm 22, Isaiah 53, where the description of his death is foretold. And I mention those two for this reason. You know, the Psalms, David said, "You will not leave my soul in Hades." David lived roughly 1,000 years B.C. And he predicted the resurrection. Isaiah 53, lived approximately 700 to 750 years before the death of Jesus on the cross. Jesus made these claims that he would arise. Now let me ask you this. What would the odds be of someone claiming that they were going to be raised from the dead after crucifixion and then it actually happening? My point being, when you consider how effective of a method of execution was, the crucifixion was, what would the odds be of the same person who said, "I'm not going to die, I'm going to be crucified, but I'm going to be resurrected"? What would be the odds of that same person being the exception to the death of crucifixion? Think about that for a minute. It doesn't make sense. So the swoon theory holds no credibility whatsoever. Then there are some who argue that Jesus was not crucified at all. And this is based on, among other things, there was a book that appeared more than 1,000 years, 1,300 years A.D., called the Gospel of Barnabas, which supposedly describes the life of Jesus. It's a favorite of Muslims because it teaches that Jesus did not die on a cross. And Muslims teach that Jesus didn't die on a cross. But what the book of Barnabas says is that somebody took his place. That somebody volunteered to take his place. Perhaps Judas Iscariot. And Judas Iscariot was made into the appearance of Jesus. And they thought they were crucifying Jesus, but they weren't. They crucified somebody else. And then Jesus made his appearances and then he was caught up to heaven. Well, there's all kinds of problems with that you can imagine. Here's my question. If that was true, who was crucified? And you still don't answer. You still don't answer about the body of Jesus. You still can't explain everything else with the disciples. The empty tomb is still recorded. Other theories, and I'm just going to mention these. These are others that I found this past week. Some say that it was a mistaken identity, that the one that they saw who appeared afterward wasn't really Jesus, it was somebody else. That's not what he was saying according to the appearances. Some say that God destroyed the physical body and then Jesus made these spiritual appearances. And this is really answered by what we talked about in the hallucination and the spiritual appearance. But some say that God destroyed his physical body, which is why you couldn't find it. Well, one observation that was made about this is, isn't it interesting that in order for this to happen, you have to have two miracles? First of all, you have to have a miracle that causes the body to disappear. And secondly, there's all these appearances. Well, the resurrection says there's one miracle, takes care of it all. And then there are some who say that Jesus appeared spiritually, but the disciples never really visited the tomb. They didn't go to where the gravesite was, and thus they thought he was physically arisen. Again, all of these, we've given you enough material to answer all of these things. They all fall short. Now, I just want to take a couple of moments, and I know my time's up. I'm not going another week. But I want to make just a couple of observations here as we start to wrap this lesson up. Number one, why is there so much opposition to the resurrection? And the reason is if you disprove the resurrection, you disprove Christianity. And in order to validate another system of belief, whether it be Islam, whether it be one of the Eastern religions such as Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, or others like that, religions that acknowledge Jesus. Muslims say he was a prophet. Some of the Eastern religions say he was one of the sages. But they deny the resurrection. And they have to validate their religions. And of course, humanism, denies miracles altogether. And thus you have to deny the resurrection. That's why it is out there. And incidentally, that is why we have to believe and understand and be able to defend the resurrection. It is the foundation of our faith. Paul said, if in this life only we have hope, we are of all men most pitiable. That's 1 Corinthians 15. What was he talking about? The resurrection. But here's another thought I want you to consider. When you look at all the preaching that takes place, the enemies of Jesus never denied the resurrection. Now they scoffed at it, and what I mean by denying it is they never presented arguments refuting it. And that's what I mean by denying it. They could not refute the resurrection. And I take you back now to the day of Pentecost. As some 40 days after, or 50 days after the burial of Jesus. Only 50 days, less than 2 months later, Peter is preaching a resurrected Jesus in Jerusalem on a major feast day. Let me ask you, do you suppose anybody from the Sanhedrin was there? Do you suppose anybody from the council was listening to this crowd when 3,000 souls obeyed the gospel? Why did they not refute what Peter and the others said? Peter said, David is dead. His grave is right over here. But Jesus, God has raised him from the dead. You may know where he was buried, but you go look at where he was buried. The tomb is empty. That was not refuted. Not once in the book of Acts is evidence presented against the resurrection. And I might add to that, not once in history, Jewish history, external history, is it refuted? It's not. You go to another example, Acts chapter 25, where Paul, he's been arrested. This is after his third journey. He's in Caesarea, and he's appearing before Festus. And Festus is meeting with Agrippa. And Festus gives instructions or speaks on this occasion, and he talks about these Jews who have come to Jerusalem, have come from Jerusalem to Caesarea to make accusations against Paul. And it says that when the accusers stood up, they brought no accusation against him of such things that I suppose, but had some questions against him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who had died, whom Paul affirmed was alive. They had arguments against against Paul, supposedly. But they could not answer against the resurrection. Paul goes on in the next chapter as he's speaking to Agrippa in chapter 26. He explains his conversion, and in verse 23 he talks about the resurrection of Jesus. And Agrippa responds to Paul by saying, you're mad because of much learning. Paul said he was not mad, and he tells Festus that these things were not done in a corner. They were not done secretly, he said. And he asks Agrippa if he believed in the prophets. And he said, I know you do. And Agrippa said, you almost persuade me to be a Christian. Possibly sarcastic. But the point is, on that occasion there, Agrippa did not deny or refute what Paul was saying. And Paul's telling Agrippa, you know about these things. They were not done in a corner. Agrippa didn't say, Paul, you know what? I'll take you to his grave. He could not refute the resurrection of Jesus. And so is the case throughout the book of Acts. and throughout teachings. And then finally, Jesus is mentioned in a number of external sources. There are many early external sources that mention the life and teachings of Jesus. And while not all of them refer to His resurrection, some of them do. Or His death and resurrection. And the point that I make in this is when you look at some of these, for example, you look at Tacitus, who was a Roman historian. And he wrote in a book called Annals, he wrote there that concerning Christianity spreading in Rome, in the empire, he said there, consequently, to get rid of the report, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations called Christians by the populace. He's talking about the destruction of the burning of Rome and how Nero blamed the Christians. He goes on, Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And a most mischievous superstition thus checked for the moment again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their center and become popular. This is not a believer. And he calls it a most mischievous superstition. That's what he calls the resurrection. Josephus, in his book Antiquities of the Jews, said there, now, there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these, and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians, so named for him, are not extinct at this day. Josephus mentions the resurrection. He was not a believer. And yet he mentions these things. Now, is he refuting them? No. You could also look at and just kind of mention these. Lucian was a second century satirist. He spoke of Christians as thinking that they were immortal. Wonder why? He says, they think they're immortal. They have contempt for death, talking about being willing to die, and they didn't care because they knew there was something after this life. Why? Because of the resurrection. And then you have the so-called church fathers, Clement, Ignatius, Justin Martyr, and many others, who in their writings frequently referenced the resurrection. And the point is these were educated men within a few years, a few decades of these events happening. And they testified in their writings to the truthfulness of these things, to an acknowledgement that they were there and they happened. Not that the individuals were there, but that the events actually occurred. Over and over you find in history proof that Jesus arose from the dead. So what is the conclusion? When you examine all the evidence, the logical conclusion is that Jesus is alive even to this day. All other theories are less credible. Yet Christianity is viciously attacked by world intellectuals and those whose perverted lifestyles cannot be defended if the Bible is true. And that's why they deny the resurrection. I want you to think about this as we conclude. You can go to Saudi Arabia and you'll find the Prophet Muhammad dead, his body still there. Buddha, while he was cremated, portions of his ashes are in various locations. Confucius in China, his tomb is occupied. Jesus, the grave is empty. And let me ask you, who do you believe in? Where is your hope? I thank you for your attention.